You're listening to The Lambcast, the official podcast of the large association of movie blogs, otherwise known as The Lamb. The Lamb is the world's biggest collection of online movie blogs, and every week on this show we invite various Lamb members on to talk about pretty much everything in our movie-loving worlds. Find The Lambcast at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Everybody, and welcome to episode 538 of the Lambcast. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, and on today's show, we're going to do a retrospective of films from director Tony Scott. Scott's second theatrical film was the international smash Top Gun, which was supposed to have its sequel, Top Gun Maverick, released this month, 34 years after the first film. Well, we all know what happened to Hollywood film plans in the last few months. Pretty much the same thing that's happened to everything else in the world. It's all screwed up. However, since we won't be getting Maverick, we can at least go back and talk about the original film as part of this discussion. The younger brother of Ridley Scott, of director Ridley Scott, also comes from the world of commercial advertising, where he was responsible for hundreds of ads from the family production house. As he transitioned to films, he made extensive use of his training and brief career as an artist, favoring a chiaroscuro form of cinematography, and yes, I did look that word up, and lighting in his films. His visual trademarks include heavy use of smoke, colored filters, and shafts of light breaking through windows. He directed 16 feature films in his career before taking his life in 2012 for reasons that are not quite certain, although it is suspected that he was facing cancer, and that was the way he was addressing the issue. We obviously don't have time to look at all 16 films, but we have a generous 50% of those movies to discuss on today's program. So joining me in this discussion will be three other lambs with a strong international flair. Let's meet them now. She runs like a woman on fire and will thunder past you on the road any day she puts on those Nikes. From Header Time, it's Heather Baxendale Walsh.
What can I tell you? I feel the need for speed.
Ow! Excellent, excellent. Our fellow Lamb members know our next guest for the unstoppable deluge of film reviews he posts on a daily basis. He watches movies like a man on fire. Welcome from Movie Rob, Movie Rob.
Thanks. They got everything here from a diddle-eyed Joe to damned if I knew.
And if you're a longtime member of the flock or have just followed for the last decade, many of you will know the former Top Gun of the Lamb. He's a previous Shepherd of the Lamb. Hungry to return as a fan, don't be surprised if you have a feeling of deja vu when you hear his voice. Welcome back, Joel Berman.
Thank you. That's a very lovely introduction.
All right. Now, before we get to the films on today's show, we have our usual business to take care of, and I do know that Joel has not had a chance to do the Bond actor rankings. So, Joel, we're putting you on the spot. Have you seen most of the James Bond films?
I actually did a complete rewatch of the entire series just a month ago. So it's very
excellent, excellent. You're in preparation for our final couple of programs toward the end of the year. We've put this off a couple of times, you know, so hopefully you'll be available to discuss them when we get there. So what we're going to ask you to do is we're going to ask you to rank the six actors in their roles as 007. And remember, this is for science, so try to be as careful as possible.
Yeah, well, it's an easy rank for the number one, and I'm in a minority, I know, but I'm going number one, Timothy Dalton.
Ah,
I feel he's so underappreciated, and I think his films, and his portrayal of Bond is like what Daniel Craig got a shit ton of credit for, but Timothy Dalton didn't. So for me, it's like Dalton is the number one.
I got to ask, did you read the Ian Fleming books?
No, I haven't.
Well, actually, the reason I ask is because, in my mind, Timothy Dalton is the closest in appearance and attitude to Bond from the books. So
oh, cool.
He's not my favorite, but he's one of my favorites. I think he's my number two. So who do you have as number two?
My number two would probably be Roger Moore.
All right.
mainly because he's actually good at, you know, humoristic quips and stuff like that. It's he's the one that's kind of defined, you know, what most entertaining Bond films are.
Yeah. Well, he was definitely the Bond for his time. And yeah. How about number three?
Pierce Brosnan. I had to go.
Yeah.
We got a couple of Pierce fans on the show.
My son's named Brosnan.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's mainly for GoldenEye. I have to say, when I rewatched the Pierce Brosnan films, it's steeped downward quite fast with him. But GoldenEye is a really good film.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of consensus on the quality of Brosnan's films, and you just nailed it. You know, it's like downhill after that first one, which is too bad. And so who do you have in fourth place?
I'll probably go George Lazenby, actually.
All right.
I mean, I know that's not a popular choice either, but it's like he only got one trial at it. And I have to say that film, when rewatching it, I was fucking impressed of how different it was, how dramatic it was, and how good the acting was. So
I think a lot of people do like that film. It's got a big cult following, but Lazenby is not usually the reason it has that cult following.
Yeah, definitely. I think he might even be dubbed in it or something. Yeah.
There are a couple of spots where he is, definitely.
Yeah.
And that means that you've got our current Bond and the first Bond in the fifth and sixth spots. Who ends up in, you know, fifth place and who ends up...
edging it out. We have Sean Connery in fifth place.
All right.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, he is very iconic as a Bond. But to be fair, when I rewatch these his old films, it felt so you know, they hadn't aged that well. And a lot also comes from his kind of acting, where he's like, he's just, you know, it's hard to explain in English, but he's kind of like this man pig. I don't know. That's a Swedish expression that I'm just translating it directly.
Chauvinistic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, chauvinist. Okay. Yeah, so it's I don't think it's aged that good, so that's why I keep him low.
All right, and that puts Daniel Craig at the bottom of the list. What is it about Daniel Craig's personification that bugs you?
Yeah, it might be that might be a personal thing where I think that he kind of gets credit for stuff that Timothy Dalton never got, you know, being a more serious and gritty Bond. But I always have the feeling when I watch the Daniel Craig Bonds, they feel more like Bourne films than Bond films. The exception, and the exception was the last film, the one with the Spectre. That felt like it was more of a traditional Bond film in a lot of ways, but I just felt that he was too old in it. It felt like a crazy Bond.
If you thought he was old in that one 5 years ago, No Time to Die is not looking good for you.
Yeah.
So, Joel, you're saying that Roger Moore was young enough to play James Bond?
Yeah, I know that he was probably the oldest one when he got the first role, but I still feel he plays it. If he felt more juvenile, I don't know, more juvenated, or, you know, had more spirit than Daniel Craig had.
More invigorated and having more fun with it, anyway.
Yeah.
Especially
so now I teared up
the jokes
completely.
Well, I would be happy to spend the rest of the 2 hours talking about Bond, but I don't think that our audience would appreciate that, since they are tuning in for the Tony Scott discussion. So thank you, Joel, for contributing to our scientific pool of data here, and we're going to move on. All right, as I said, Tony Scott directed 16 feature films, and we've trimmed our discussion down to 8. We're going to be talking about his first film, The Hunger, and then Top Gun. We're also going to cover The Last Boy Scout, True Romance, Crimson Tide, Enemy of the State, Man on Fire, and his final film, Unstoppable. All right. Well, most of you probably haven't had your breakfast yet, or if you have, you probably ate something light, and so you have a strong desire to eat something more. Let's talk about your hunger.
Hey guys, this is Aaron Newworth. I'm so sorry I could not be here for this recording, but I am a big Tony Scott fan, so I wanted to provide various audio clips of me talking about the Tony Scott movies you guys are discussing today, and I'm going to try to make them as quick as I can. So, The Hunger, Tony Scott's first film, definitely has a lot of style, very much fits with the vibe of Tony Scott films. Not the best. There's some intriguing performances where you have Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie, and it's a vampire movie where they don't say vampire, which is always neat. But overall, a little bit forgettable, but still very stylistic, and certainly shows where he'd go from there.
Right. Rob.
David Bowie's involved. I'm hungry.
Yes. Rob, what did you think of The Hunger? What's your background with it? What did you think of it? How do you feel it holds up as a film?
Okay, this is actually the only one of the eight films that we discussed that we're going to be discussing that I haven't seen before. And I hadn't necessarily heard the best things about The Hunger, so I was a little trepidatious to see it, but I figured, what the hell? You know, I've seen worse movies, for less, so I'll try it out and see what it is. I found it to be an interesting take on the whole vampire genre, where they don't even mention the word vampire, but it's very clear that that's what they're talking about here. It's much darker than all the other films that Tony Scott did. I think he learned from making that film that wasn't the type of movies that he's necessarily good at making. Because if you look at every one of his other movies, they're all action thrillers. And this was a very slow moving, vampire story that's told in a very sensual way, because it has a lot to do with, okay, what does a vampire do for love to pass the time, that type of thing. And there's it's got a very nice cast. I mean, you have Catherine Deneuve in the lead role, and then you have David Bowie, as was mentioned earlier. And you also have Susan Sarandon in one of her earlier roles. And there's sort of, at certain points, this love triangle between the three of them. I wouldn't necessarily classify it exactly as a love triangle, but it's played out that way. I don't want to give away too much for anyone who wants to see this.
Yeah.
So again, it was fine. I've seen better vampire movies. I've definitely seen better Tony Scott movies. It's just not really my type of thing.
All right. And Heather, you are hot for David Bowie, so this must have been a movie that appealed to you.
Yes, and strangely enough, I'd never seen it before, and I have a thing for vampires, and obviously Bowie, so it's quite peculiar that I never had watched it before, but I actually enjoyed it. I do not think it was a great movie by any means. It was just really weird, and sometimes I like things that are a little off-kilter. I think you made a good point, Rob, where you said it just kind of moves along and it's relatively slow, and in the first scene you kind of get this very, very intense theme of sound and visual and sexual tension, and that kind of dissipates relatively quickly, and it's much more a lot of style over substance, I think is the way I would describe it. But at the same time,
I would agree with that.
It still is somewhat visceral. The performances were interesting. If anything, I was watching it more out of just, I just would like to see more of the actors and just watching them rather than the actual story. I wasn't as wrapped up in the story as I was enjoying watching it. And some of the things I found interesting was seeing some of the ways Tony shot that he ended up employing later in his films, playing with lighting and things like that, where I really, really enjoyed some of those scenes that were more still. Yeah. As a generality, I wouldn't necessarily recommend this movie to most people unless either you're into the players involved or vampires or kind of a B vampire movie.
and Joel, you hadn't seen this one, so let me jump in with a few comments, because I'm just going to echo things that both Rob and Heather have said. This is a movie that is definitely all style. As you're looking at the way it's shot, you can see the Tony Scott that's going to be coming in the next two decades. There's a lot of lighting effects and a lot of clever angles that are being used. There's use of source music that I think is pretty effective. But this is a slow-moving story that's not really action-based. It does feature sensuality in one spot that I thought was pretty effective at raising the temperature in the room, but the movie definitely is cool. I mean, it's all dark blues and grays, and there are a couple of scenes where the lighting changes dramatically. I was surprised at a couple of twists that the movie took, and although John, the character played by David Bowie, is a somewhat sympathetic character, he's also a reprehensible character, as most vampires in the long run are. And it's an interesting twist on, relationships and how these things work. They have a different twist on the kind of life cycle of vampires, and I thought that that was interesting. But I could see why it wasn't a huge success, and it kind of stalled Tony Scott. Apparently, he was originally scheduled to direct Man on Fire, the earlier version, and they said nope after seeing this movie. And
I think he was happier that way because he got Top Gun.
Well, I'm sure it worked out in the long run because his next movie is so much better. We do want to do Lamb ratings as we go along, so I know Joel doesn't have one, so he didn't see it. Rob, how about you? What's your Lamb rating for The Hunger?
I would give it a 3 out of 5.
All right, and Heather,
I'm being
how about
a little
you?
Generous, but yeah.
I would give it a 2.5 out of 5. It was really lovely to look at.
All right, and I would give it a 3 out of 5 primarily because not David Bowie, although he was perfectly fine, but I've always had a little thing for Susan Sarandon, and this gives me more reason to have something for Susan Sarandon.
I really enjoyed her in this, too. I'm not always a fan of hers, but in this particular film, I thought she was wonderful and so beautiful.
Yes.
Have you heard the trivia about with Susan Sarandon? That originally the screenplay had it that she was supposed to be drunk right before her big scene with Catherine Deneuve, and she actually asked for them to change it so that she only takes one sip of wine and then throws away the rest of the glass. She said she wanted to completely make it clear that her character was choosing to be with Catherine Deneuve instead of doing it because she was drunk or any other reason. And then she said, "You wouldn't have to get drunk to bed, Catherine Deneuve. I don't care what your sexual history is at that point."
Yeah. Well, I like that information, and I can 100% agree.
All right. That appears on, I think, a documentary that she was in, The Celluloid Closet.
Okay. That makes sense.
Okay.
All right. Well, as somebody said it earlier, I feel a need for speed, so let's Top Gun, because this is obviously the breakthrough film for not only Tony Scott, but it raised Tom Cruise to an even higher level, although he had had some success and
Risky Business
was a rising star. It was certainly nothing before compared to what came after this particular film. So is there any chance that any of you hadn't seen this before this week?
I saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
I was 10, but I still saw, or 11. I saw it in the theater still.
I saw it at the drive-in.
Joel, did you see it when it was first in theaters?
No. I think this was a home video release for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I saw it in theaters as well, and many times over the years. So,
Top Gun. Okay. I know that Top Gun has a large fan base. I can recognize that there's a lot of iconicism in Top Gun. There's a lot of shots and memorable moments, of course, with the volleyball scene and the jets and the sing-alongs and everything. I think Top Gun is not that great of a movie. It has Tom Cruise being very good at it. It has a lot of people being very good at it. It has a lot of homoeroticism that is, I think, encouraged in a way that actually benefits the film more than the key romance between the man and the woman. However, Top Gun, it's fine.
Let's see. Joel, why don't we start with you? What do you think of Top Gun? What are your impressions?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic film in so many ways. I mean, people that might remember my film taste is that I kind of like it when stories are really straightforward and I can appreciate really easy storytelling and almost like stereotypical characters. And I mean, this has like, this is almost like, how would you say, like, it's a perfect example of all that. And I mean, it's superb action, and it's good chemistry between Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis, and the duel between him and Val Kilmer. It's also fantastic. So it's like, to me, it's a really, really solid film. And it's kind of interesting that he made the film that you guys had seen first, and then he did this, and it's almost like, I mean, even after Top Gun, he kind of has his own style, but it's not really as bombastic as this one. And I find that kind of interesting, how it became like that. I mean, it's just a superb film in so many ways.
Well, there's definitely the influence of Simpson Bruckheimer on this. You know, this is one
Yeah, I guess they probably kind of couch directed a little bit, maybe, because he was not that experienced, and I guess that might explain why it's maybe feels a little bit different than. I mean, it's still the rest of his filmography is also terrific, but I do feel like this one sticks out of his more, action works in a way.
All right, Heather, how about you?
I love this movie. I know that some of it's dated too. I think the longest period of time I went without seeing it was maybe 5 years. And my boyfriend, now husband at the time, had never seen it because he hated Tom Cruise. And he had never seen any Tom Cruise movies because he hated Tom Cruise. And I said, sit the F down. You're going to watch this. And he was like, all right, that was really awesome. I'm like, yes, yes, I'm in. And since then, too, he has become a fan of Tom Cruise and separated him as a human from an actor. But, okay. But I mean, even as a kid, I was little when I saw this. We came back. We had just moved back to Michigan, and there was a drive-in theater right down the road. We went and saw it. It was fantastic, even with the crappy sound with the little speakers in the car. But and when you would get bits where you couldn't hear the actual sound or dialogue, you still could see the dogfights and the planes, and the practical effects in it are just they hold up so beautifully today. When they talked about doing a sequel, all I could do was hope that they'd still make the action sequences in the same breath and inspiration. And it sounds like they have, so I'm very excited about that. But it's such
Heather,
a fun
Heather,
movie.
Where was the drive-in?
Gosh,
don't forget, I'm also from Detroit.
Michigan Ave, Westland area. There's a big Ford plant there now. They mowed it over about 15, 20 years ago.
I think I know where that is.
Yeah, right off of Michigan Ave and 275. I forgot what it was called exactly, but yeah, it was quite sad. But it was
you
can
look it up
movie.
On Cinema Treasures or Google Maps.
we usually went to the Americanas.
They still have the Ford Theater in Dearborn. That one is still there. You can actually right now they reopened it, so you can go watch movies there because you can social distance in your cars. But yeah, it was just a great experience as a kid and an adult, and it's just massively enjoyable. It's so much fun.
Yeah, you know, this was the last of the films that I watched for this show, and it was last night at 8:30. I said, this is going to be my third film of the afternoon evening, and I thought maybe I'll try and do it in the morning. And I said, no, I'm just never going to get that done before the show. I've got so many other things. So I stayed up to watch it, and it was easy to do. First of all, it's briefer than some of the other films. It's not short, but it's briefer, and it moves really quickly. And it's got all those things that Tony Scott was noted for in it, although you can the action beats feel a little bit different, and the story definitely feels different than some of those other films. The one thing I was struck with, you were, you know, Heather, you were mentioning Tom Cruise, and I think Tom Cruise is, you know, I'm a fan. You know, I like Tom Cruise movies, and I was watching this though, and he looks like a baby in this
movie. Yeah.
You know, when people talk about Tom Cruise, you know, must having, you know, the portrait someplace in the attic, and he never ages, I say, well, look at Mission Impossible, Fallout, and then look at this film, and you'll see that there's a difference. It's still the same guy. There is aging that's going on, but he looked like he had baby fat on his face.
Yes, and, yes.
And when he's in those scenes with Kelly McGillis, although I thought that their chemistry was okay, she just looked like she was 10 years too old for him. And so that sometimes felt a little bit awkward. But he needed to be a young character because that's the kind of person that would be a naval aviator, and they would have that kind of attitude. And I, you know, when you're watching the film, it's easy to be swept away by the visuals and not pay that much attention to the story, which is kind of you know, like Joel said, it's very simple and direct. Maybe it's a little hackneyed, but it's one of those things that I think works pretty well. The dogfights are fantastic. The shots off of the planes are amazing. You know that they are going to be. I mean, Tom Cruise has learned to fly these kinds of planes now. So when we see Maverick, I expect those shots will not only be up to snuff, they'll probably be even better than we got in this film. This film looks great from the, you know, cinematography and the way that it's shot. So I understand why it became a big hit. And, of course, the music is so much fun.
Danger Zone. Yes.
Danger Zone. almost got my Archer Zone soundboard out for that.
Yeah.
You know?
Lana.
So even the opening theme is just so much fun to listen to.
It's mm-hmm. great music. It really is. My dad, years ago, he decided to take a trip cross country with his girlfriend at the time, now wife. And he asked me to make him a playlist, and it was mostly like just Boston and Foreigner. And then I randomly just threw Danger Zone in there, and he called me, "You put Danger Zone on here!" So I almost got a ticket driving fast. Yes, the song is that effective.
Yeah, and then of course you've got the Berlin song of, you know,
Taking My Breath Away. Right, but,
It was nominated for Academy Award. It didn't win, did it? Rob, you'll
know. It won.
It did win. Okay.
It won.
So yeah, Giorgio Moroder and somebody else was involved in writing that, and that was that band's biggest hit.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no question about that. One hit wonder.
Well, I listen to a lot of new wave music in the early 80s, so I could name a couple of other songs that they did. But yes, you were right. That when it comes to hits, that would be the one that everybody knows. And Terry Nunn, who's the lead singer of Berlin, by the way, she was one of the finalists for the role of Princess Leia.
Oh.
She'd been a Pet House pet, I think, as well.
She's been very busy.
Yes. All right. Well, now that we've listened to the soundtrack of the 80s and we've introduced ourselves to Tom Cruise, who will be the biggest star in Hollywood for the next 30 years. Yeah, Heather, Top Gun, before we get to Last Boy Scout, you got a rating for Top Gun?
5 out of 5. It's pure gold.
Okay. Joel, how about you?
Is it half lamb still, or is
yeah,
it
you can do a half lamb. That's no problem.
Four and a half.
All right.
Probably and seen Rob? It times.
Four and a half.
Yeah, and I'm going to go 4.5 also. You know, there are a couple of things that may be a little, like I said, clunky and heavy-handed, but I can live with it. We will move on, but we're not going to go to Days of Thunder, which was the follow-up between Tony Scott and Tom Cruise. We're going to skip ahead to what feels to me very much like an 80s-era action buddy comedy, but one that's missed its sell-by date by a couple of years. It's 1991's The Last Boy Scout. All right. Well, like I said, we get an action buddy comedy next, written by Shane Black, so it's going to definitely have a different feel to it. The Last Boy Scout is an interesting film. Like I said, it's got a lot of those tropes from the 80s, but it does come to us in the early 90s.
The Last Boy Scout is a wild, very misogynistic, action-heavy ride that barely makes sense, but still I think pulls it off because Shane Black's script has so many great lines for Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans to work with. Their chemistry together rocks. The very kind of Joel Silver-esque action that's violent and large scale, I think, works to its advantage. So it works as a fun buddy cop movie, even though it's a private eye and a football player, an ex-football player. But I have a lot of fun with The Last Boy Scout. Too many funny lines not to.
Joel, you saw this film recently, right?
No, I've seen it. This was one of the films that I didn't have time to read. I've seen it before, and my impression then was that I was super disappointed because I've heard just what you said, that it's very Shane Blacky and it's supposed to be good. But I thought it was quite boring back then. But I mean, I haven't rewatched it. But I do genuinely remember that I wasn't like really prone to see it again. So that's why it was like on the last on my list.
I didn't get it in time. I got you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, how about you, Heather? You've seen it, right, recently?
Yes, I rewatched it. That was part of the joy of this, is a lot of these movies I hadn't seen in as much as a decade and some longer. So rewatching them with fresh eyes, older eyes, and seeing how they've done with the test of time has been interesting. This, I have no idea how I never saw from start to finish, though. It's one of those movies that was on often in my house growing up. My parents, this was the kind of movie that was always on in my house with my parents. So I would catch bits here and there. I was a big Damon Wayans fan. Both my parents loved Bruce Willis. And I always remember liking it, watching it, but never like going, I'm going to watch that. Yeah, I'm going to sit down and watch that by myself. So this is the first time from start to finish that I watched it. And it is an absolute riot. It's just it's exactly the kind of fun buddy cop movies that, well, I just miss because they don't make them anymore. And perhaps it doesn't make it into like my top 20 of all time list or anything, but it's perfectly enjoyable and an absolute delight. The action in it is spot on. There's wonderful banter and chemistry between Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans. I didn't expect what happened to Halle Berry happened to Halle Berry. I was singing along with, I want to be a cowboy. You can be my cowgirl. I'm like, this is good. This is great. Yeah, I just kind of got wrapped up in it, and I just enjoyed myself for 2 hours. And that's exactly what you hope for when you watch this brand of movie. So I thought it was very effective and a pleasant surprise.
Rob, were you pleasantly surprised?
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is another one of the movies I saw in the theater. And I've always been a Bruce Willis fan ever since I first saw Die Hard. And this is one of my, this is just such a fun movie, as Heather mentioned. I mean, it's the type of movie that you can sit down and watch and just enjoy so much, even though there's a lot of stupid things that happen in it. There's a lot of, you know, the characters act stupidly and don't do things very smart or whatever, but it's just so much fun. And the way that they also put together the whole thing with sports and the whole idea of sports betting and the mafia and all these other things that you wouldn't necessarily put together. I mean, Shane Black is at least at that time, he was a great writer and was able to put together all these different aspects of a story that you wouldn't necessarily think to put together. Heather mentioned the banter between the characters, which is great, but also this film has great one-liners and there's a lot of self-depreciating humor that just works so well here. The characters, you know, make fun of each other, but they also make fun of themselves. And it's just so enjoyable. I mean, this is a movie that I've seen a lot of times, and I actually rewatched all eight of these movies about a week and a half ago for the show, and this one I hadn't seen in I think about close to 6 years, and it was just it immediately all came back to me, and I was I started watching it within 5 minutes I was back into it, and it was just I was remembering all these different parts of it, and it was just so much fun to watch. So, it's not a perfect movie, but if you're just looking for an enjoyable, fun movie, as you guys mentioned before, something from the 90s that probably should have been made in the late 80s, but still is quite effective. And even after nearly 30 years, it still works.
Yeah, I think my problem with it is that I had seen so many of those other films, and the tropes were so well known and repeated, and it was so over the top. It just felt tired to me. There's stuff in it that's entertaining, and if you hadn't seen all of those other movies and this was the only one that you were seeing and you hadn't seen any others in a while, then I could see that there's entertainment value in it. But it was the one that I had the least favorable impression of before my rewatch this last week. And then it still is at the bottom of my list of the Tony Scott films that I watched.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. It's just, well, you hinted at it. A lot of things happen that are kind of stupid or so traditional. You know, the little girl getting involved in the plot line in the last third of the movie, you could see that coming from a mile away when it happens. It's so obvious. Stupid things happen three times to keep her in the story. That's a little bit annoying. The over-the-top stuff that happens toward the end. Look, I appreciate somebody being shot, falling from a high space, and then having to fall through a helicopter propeller. That's all good for me.
Yeah, it's true.
But it's like, how much of that kind of stuff can you take? And there's just a lot of that kind of stuff that happens in this movie. And it just feels so, full of these ridiculous ideas and pressing. The wide receiver catching the ball and then, winding his way down the field using a handgun to clear the path. maybe there are performance-enhancing drugs that are part of that. Maybe he's so stressed about what's going on. But it's just like, and that's at the start of the film. And it just keeps going that way. Yeah, it feels like a lesser Bruce Willis. He did a ton, and he still is doing a ton of these kinds of movies. And it feels like, to me, a little bit tired. It looks good for the most part, and there are a lot of actors in it that are a lot of fun, so I appreciated that. The sports thing, I like the idea of tying it into a sports thing, but it could be a little bit more realistic. The idea that the owner of a football team, they're worried about ratings falling off, and the solution to the problem is to get involved in getting it's so convoluted, and like I said, plotting is not really one of those things that should be very important in a film like this, but there ought to be something that makes sense about it, and I didn't care for it. So I'm going to be the dissenting opinion on this, although I think Joel is probably closer to me than to you two.
I don't know. Now I'm curious to rewatch it since it's other guys.
which means we actually won that one, Richard, because okay. We convinced him to watch it.
Yes.
I don't know that curiosity means that you were correct in your assessment. People do rubberneck at car wrecks, and I think that Joel might be doing that right now.
I wouldn't call it a car wreck. I think films like these sometimes, or often even, there's ridiculous things that ensue. And sometimes I question my own liking to a film and go, is my enjoyment here based on mostly nostalgia? Is this actually still a really good movie, or do I just love it because it's so personal to me at this point? And this is one of those movies that I feel like, well, yeah, there's a lot of really good here. And as you guys mentioned, there's some things that don't work as well. But if the entertainment aspect outweighs the silly, nonsensical stuff, then it's still a fun movie to watch and not so much a train wreck. Yeah. It's the balance of that when you start to have those flounderings.
Well,
right, Richard, I think one of the things about this movie is that it's possible that Shane Black took all these different table scraps of ideas and tried to put them all together. Yeah. And that's why it somewhat looks like a jigsaw puzzle that didn't quite make it together. But that's part of the whole fun of it, because there are so many aspects.
They're following a recipe, and you know it's a recipe. It's a solid recipe. It's worked 100 times. Like I said, I was just there's a point at which I say I can't eat another hamburger because you know I'm just bored with them. And the same thing happens here. Sometimes you just get to a point where you say, this feels boring to me, and that's the way I felt while I was watching the movie. There were other films in this genre, you know, buddy cop films with a comedy aspect to it that I enjoyed more. I mean, we'd already had a couple of Lethal Weapons at this point, and, of course, Beverly Hills Cop, and a lot of those other kinds of films with humor-based action that's going on. And it just felt, like I said, a little tired to me. It doesn't necessarily make it a bad film, but it made it one that I didn't respond very well to, although obviously you guys are enthusiastic about it.
Apparently.
All right. Well, let's see if we can find something that people are a little bit more enthusiastic about, and maybe we've got a consensus.
Let's give ratings.
We should ratings, thank you.
I keep forgetting that. Thank you for keeping me on track.
Richard, do you want like a code that I'll say, you know?
No. You don't have to say Afghanistan banana stand. I'll remember. I just have to remind myself to do it. Yes. So, Joel hasn't had a chance to see it again.
I'm not going to grade it.
You're not going to rate it. Okay, Rob, what would you give it?
I'd give it a 4 out of 5.
Okay, and Heather, how about you?
It's just nonsensical fun. I'd give it a 3.5 out of 5.
All right. And like I said, I didn't hate it, but it kind of bored me at times. So I'll give it 2 out of 5, you know. It's not a disaster, but it's not something I ever need to see again.
Fair.
All right. Well, next we have a Quentin Tarantino script for True Romance. It grew out of a combined story that became separate films. Another film that also was not directed by Tarantino, Natural Born Killers. So, you know, this combined story got to be all over the place, and Tarantino ended up selling the story for apparently a minimal amount of money and didn't direct either film that was made from this idea. But Tony Scott did make an interesting film out of True Romance, and it seems to be a fan favorite. A lot of people really like this movie.
True Romance is my favorite Tony Scott film. That's just easy for me to say. It is written by Quentin Tarantino, so automatically that puts it up on a higher level for me. But the cast is so like gigantic and wonderful. You have so many great isolated scenes, particularly the Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper moment, obviously. But I just really love this entire cast. The dialogue is fantastic. I think Tony Scott mixed with Tarantino is a great one. Just the kind of adrenaline and momentum that Tony Scott pushes on top of what Tarantino is able to do with dialogue, I think really works in this film's favor. I have a blast watching this one a lot.
Rob, why do you think that's so? And do you agree that
well,
it's...
First of all, it takes place in Detroit. So
yeah, it doesn't feel like Detroit though.
Just the first part takes place.
No, the suburb scenes you can believe a little more.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. And the comic book store, come on.
Yeah. Right, well, I did see a comment somewhere that Tarantino said that this is the closest to being an autobiographical film that he had. I can see that he might see himself as Clarence a little bit.
So he married a.
Well, I don't know who his wife is. I don't want to suggest that she's a former call girl, but I do know that he was. But he was a movie geek who worked in a video store, and his partner at the store is the one that he created these stories with, and subsequently Pulp Fiction as well. And of course the The idea that you're seeped in a particular kind of milieu, in this case comic books as opposed to movies, but a little bit of the movies also, and that you've got a fixation with Elvis as your invisible mentor, that sounds like Tarantino.
Yeah.
Heather, what's
Wait,
your
I didn't
impression
finish
of
talking
the film?
About it. I just said Detroit.
Well, you jumped in, and I'm going to get her to. We'll come back to you. We'll come back to you. You're a Detroit person. Did you think it was like Detroit?
It didn't feel like Detroit to me. I completely forgot that it was a Detroit setting after the first 5 minutes, and I haven't watched it in at least 10 years. So the impact of that was just. I did not get the feel of Detroit. I didn't get the mood of Detroit. There was definitely not Detroit for me there. Which I look for because I want my city. Detroit has anything, it has a lot of freaking soul. It has its own character and personality. And Tarantino usually does a pretty good job of working with the setting and that kind of thing. And the same thing with Tony Scott. But I just don't think the two of them together really pulled Detroit. It felt like it was in L.A. to me, especially
Half is an L.A. thing.
Yeah, right. But it didn't feel like there was any transition for me as much. Yeah.
Well, neither Joel or I are from the former murder capital of the country. So
I think it might be back. I think we might have taken the title back. We got to be good at something here.
So it's a little hard for us to say for sure. But let's talk about the film itself. I know that Rob feels like I robbed him. So go ahead, Rob. Tell us what you thought of the movie.
That's all right, Richard. I never think that you're going to rob me. That's fine. No one can out rob Rob. How's that? So this is a movie that I saw not long after it came out, and I fell in love with it the first time I saw it, and I've seen it so many times since, because it's actually one of my favorite Tarantino written movies, because of the dialogue and the characters, they're just great. And I remember all these for so many years I had always heard that there's a Quentin Tarantino cut of the movie, which is very different from the Tony Scott one. And I was always curious to see it. And I said, oh, since I love Tarantino and I love the way Tarantino writes, I'm going to love his cut. And I finally saw his cut a few years ago, and it's just not as good as Tony Scott's, because Tarantino loves doing flashbacks and things like that. And that's the way his cut works.
Yeah, it's organized differently, I think.
His cut starts in the middle when they're on their way to L.A., and then it flashes back to what happened in Detroit and stuff like that. And it just isn't as effective.
Where did you see
also, the
it,
ending
the
is
way.
Different. I'm sorry?
Where did you see that Tarantino version of the movie?
I found a copy of it online somewhere. I don't remember where it was. It was like 5 years ago I saw it. But it felt too much like some of the other stuff that Tarantino did. But here, the way that the story plays out in the Tony Scott version plays out much better, in my opinion. Also, the ending is different in the Tarantino version. If anyone wants me to spoil it, I could say what happens. But that's only if you want. The characters are great here. I mean, Christian Slater is amazing in the lead role, because you don't expect him to play this type of character. And with him and Patricia Arquette together, they have just great chemistry. Even though parts of the movie it fits into your typical how do I even put it?
Criminal couple on the run.
Exactly. That's basically what it is. You know, you got it right there. But it still really works, and the supporting cast is great, because you have Bronson Pinchot in a small role, and you have Saul Rubinick in a great role, which apparently he's supposedly making fun of Joel Silver in that
he was fantastic.
He really was, and you have Dennis Hopper in a small role that works really well, and Gary Oldman. Who plays a role that we can't talk about anymore because of everything that's going on now. And you have Christopher Walken in one scene, but he's so memorable in that scene. And most people probably miss that Samuel L. Jackson's in this movie too, because he doesn't last very long.
Nobody lasts very long in this movie.
That's true. Also. And James Gandolfini also is great in it. You know.
All right.
So watching it now, you see how many famous people who weren't famous at the time, you know, found their way into this movie, which is just so much fun to watch.
Joel, how about you?
Yeah, this was the best thing with going on this podcast, because believe it or not, I'd never seen this one before. Can't believe I'm saying that.
Wow.
And it was such a great experience. I mean, it's like, it also, I have to fucking give credit for Tony Scott also for being like, you know, interpreting a script in a real good way, because I had to check this. But apparently, as I understand it, Reservoir Dogs had been released before this.
Yes.
So I think he must have seen that, and kind of when he read the script that Tarantino had written, he kind of like, okay, I have to direct it in a certain way, because it does very much feel like a Quentin Tarantino film as a director as well, but in such a good way, because we don't get the what you were talking about in that different cut, you know, when it's just thrown around the time wise, because sometimes that can feel very contrived. And I think as this one is plotted out, it's a really good narrative. And I have to say that the opening scene in the cinema where she stumbles upon him for the first time and how they meet is so fucking brilliant, and how she then is outside crying outside the window when she realizes that she actually have feelings for him, and she tells that thing. It's so cute and lovable, and it's like the perfect setup in so many ways. And also, I was so glad to see Dennis Hopper playing a different character than we're so used to seeing him playing like these insane bad guys types, and he's great at it. But he was fucking great as well here, playing like this just, you know, really good father figure. Same thing with Christopher Walken. I think he is overused in so many ways, and that he's just playing it, phoning it in, kind of. But the scene with him here was really, really nice to see him acting again, like really, you know, he's digging it in a way. So it's such a great experience seeing this one for the first time.
Well, good. I think everybody's enthusiastic about this movie for the most part. I like it quite well. I do think that it feels, and probably appropriately, feels a little bit more comic booky than other Tarantino films. It's funny because I think Tony Scott presents the elements of the movie in a way that are, especially the violence, in a way that is, if not comic, at least it's got an edge to it that is somewhat humorous or lighthearted in nature and doesn't feel as intense as some of the Tarantino-directed violence.
Well,
things.
Actually, that's one of the things I thought that he got right with Tarantino, is I think a lot of Tarantino's violence is hilarious and is intended
to be.
So.
But,
and that's certainly one of the things that I felt like he actually tuned into really well.
Especially in the hotel room scene.
Yeah, the hotel room scene with Gandolfini and Arquette.
I wasn't talking about that one.
Oh, well, that's the one I'm talking about. To me, that's the best scene in the movie. Because that feels the most like what's going on is really violent and is really amusing at the same time, in kind of a grotesque way, like the way the violence is in most Tarantino films. I like you compare the scenes in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood there at the end with this one, and I get a very familiar vibe from those two scenes. I don't get the same kind of thing with the last scene with the big shootout at the end of the film. That really felt to me like it was from a completely different screenwriter, and it's probably the director's influence there, because he's making choices that make the actors look a little bit more humorous and comic booky. Not the scenario, not the actions that they're doing, but the actors themselves. And I thought that was like I said, not a bad thing, but definitely a different thing. I like the movie. I liked it really well. And Rob, you said you were surprised that Christian Slater's playing a part like this. To me, this is exactly the kind of part that he always plays. He's, you know, kind of a sly guy who's a little bit of a loser, but has the potential to be charming at times, but is also a little dangerous. And, you know, Christian Slater, I think that that's what's on his resume when they send his CV around to all of the you know, studios. They say, well, this is what we're looking for, this guy right here.
Slightly sleazy, but we like him a lot.
Yeah, you know, there's something about him that's appealing, and I would agree that, you know, I think it was Joel who said it, that opening section where the two of them have the creepiest cute meet in the world, but it's also got a charm to it and a sweetness to it, and
Especially for movie lovers like us.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And the way they, you know, come together at the theater, and then they talk about things afterwards, and the next thing you know, they're ready to get married, and you go, how could that happen? And they go, what? I believe that. I felt like that could be, even though I know it's a contrivance of the film, I felt like that could be the case. And then, of course, all of the insane characters that go along. You mentioned Gary Oldman, and Brad Pitt apparently improvised everything that he did in the movie.
it seems as if he really was stoned during all those
things. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all that he just visited the set and they said, here, put this hat on and say stuff every once in a while.
Hey, don't forget toilet paper.
You want to hang out with me and watch TV for a little bit?
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. Do you guys remember more of the backstory to how this film was made? Because to me, seeing it the first time this late, it feels like it. Just looking at it, it feels like it must have been like an indie film or something back then.
Well, yeah, and for me, it's also it had been a long time since I'd seen it. So when I did, I'd forgotten a lot. I'd forgotten half the actors that were in it, but it did almost have that feel to it. And I think that's almost because, I mean, let's be honest, Tarantino films still, even with a big budget and whatnot, his films still have that gritty feel to it. And the story is his.
Right.
And Tony just told it. So I feel like it still has that feel to it too.
Well, the dialogue has that feel to it. And
yeah,
the
no question
plot
about
does too. Like I said, but I think you can, not just the way that the story is structured, but in other ways you can tell that somebody else is in charge here. And the Tony Scott stuff, you know, we're back to some of those visual things. I think you see a lot of that in this film as well.
Like the roller coaster scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I'm not sure is necessary, but you know what? It works. It gives you
exactly
a chance
it's
to
fun.
Have something about those characters, and it's a little bit different. And again, it's an interesting shot, you know, watching them on the roller coaster.
Right.
I'd say that about a lot of the movie, though. So much of it feels like it shouldn't work, but it does.
Yeah.
And you get a Tarantino film, or a story, pardon me, that's told in an actual linear fashion.
Yes.
So you see that his storytelling can still work in the hands of somebody else, but it's different, but it's still, I just think it was an interesting mashup.
Yeah.
Is really what it was.
Also, one thing that I thought was interesting was that, you know, the editing in the Dennis Hopper and the Christopher Walken scene, it felt very much like Quentin Tarantino.
That scene, yes.
But that's because of the dialogue. I mean, the dialogue is just superb.
But it's also the long takes of it and how it's just that one scene, and it gets to take its time in a way that Quentin Tarantino is so good at. So I still feel like that Tony Scott, I mean, it feels like, I mean, someone could say that he didn't influence the film enough, but I would see it in another way, that he made the best film out of the script since Tarantino wasn't around to do it.
Right. I mean, Tarantino himself even said that that the way that Scott made this movie and the way that he changed the ending to a quote-unquote happier ending than Tarantino wanted, he said, works really well for what Tony Scott wanted to do. Tarantino said he would have done it completely different, but he agreed that it works well.
What was his ending?
Basically that the main character ends up dying, and then Patricia Arquette's character says, I didn't really care about him anyway. All I wanted was the money. And then she goes, then she moves on to go to a, you know, to go on her own cross-country
at some adventure. Point, connecting with Harvey Keitel and having their adventures down the road.
Exactly.
That would require the film to be entirely directed by Tarantino to work. Because
correct.
There's a reason why Tarantino movies are Tarantino movies is because he somehow makes those bizarre things function appropriately. I think for what Tony Scott did, that was the ending that worked here.
No,
and you still had a Tarantino blow them up, everybody shooting each other at the end moment.
Yeah, you know, you had one of those standoffs everywhere.
Mexican
standoffs.
Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't stop laughing.
Very traditional.
This should not be funny. It's hysterical.
Okay, well, I remembered this time that we do need to do ratings before we move on. So, Heather, how about you? Why don't we start with you?
Oh, it's solid, good fun with just outstanding performances. The dialogue is exceptional, and it's fun to watch. 4 out of 5 for me.
All right. And Joel?
Based on this one viewing alone, 5 out of 5.
Definitely. Ah, very damn good. You're enthusiastic. Rob, how about you?
I'm also going with the 5 out of 5. This is my favorite of all the 8 movies that we've seen.
Okay. And I'm going to go with a 4 as well. I like the movie quite well. There are things about it that I don't say they are problematic, but they maybe aren't quite as satisfying as I would like them to be. But that's just, you know, personal preference at that moment. And I think this was only the third time I've seen the movie. And I was pleased with it. I seem to remember liking it a little bit better, but that doesn't mean that I disliked it.
Right. One more thing, Richard, sure. One more thing before we move on to the next movie. I wanted to mention about Michael Rapaport. I thought he was hilarious in this movie, especially
yes, he
plays this. He plays this actor who, when you see him doing his acting, you say, "Oh my God, he's so terrible," and he actually gets the part.
Well, I when we were talking about the sweet opening between those two people, I also kind of thought that character was a little endearing. He's such a puppy dog. He wants to be successful in this particular field. He's doing what he can to do so, and he's so excited about the idea that he's going to, you know, work with Captain Kirk.
That's right.
All right. Well, next up, we get something that I think is pretty special from my perspective, because we get a movie that features my two favorite actors working together in a submarine story. I don't know how it gets any better unless Sean Connery shows up.
I didn't know you were a fan of Viggo Mortensen.
Yes, that is actually the correct answer.
So, apparently some of you are more enthusiastic about Viggo than you are about Denzel or Gene. But I tell you what, for most of the last 40 years, Gene Hackman has been my favorite actor, and since he stopped working, Denzel Washington has been my favorite working actor, and the fact that they are in this movie together and they have, you know, most of their, I won't not say all of their scenes, but a lot of scenes together, this is what makes this movie so great from my perspective.
No question about it.
Yep.
And it's a submarine movie. So, do you guys like submarine movies?
Nope.
No?
There's one submarine movie prior to this, and that was The Hunt for Red October. This is now one of my submarine movies. I accept
it. Okay. Good deal. Good deal.
Many regard Crimson Tide as Tony Scott's best film. I would be inclined to say, yeah, why not? It certainly is a strong film from him as a director, matched with a very smart script about two men that are basically right but also wrong, as Jason Robards says towards the end of the film. But you have Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman in lead roles, which is terrific. They're very good in this movie, as you'd expect. It's also a Jerry Bruckheimer production, so that means you have a great select number of supporting cast members that are great actors in themselves. A lot of great tension, a very fun submarine movie, just plays on all cylinders as far as big summer entertainment.
Joel, you did see this one, right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's start with you. What do you think of the Crimson Tide?
Same with True Romance. This was the first time seeing this one. I didn't have any preconceptions going in or anything. What intrigued me the most was the mind game between Denzel and Gene Hackman, because it felt like they really went, you know, they really based their decisions on what they thought was right. And it was like, it was an interesting tug of war. Because I mean, the entire film takes place in the submarine, so we don't even see anything on the surface. So it's all about how to decide how to, you know, attack these rebels in the Russia and how that will cause consequences for the entire world. So I really like that kind of high stakes game concentrated in these two minds, and the politics on the submarine as well. You know, on how you do a mutiny, correct or not, and stuff like that. So I had a little bit problem with the submarine lingo, but I thought it was a very enjoyable film, and actually quite tenseful in a lot of ways. And I mean, it's two really good performances by both of them. And I mean, if we're going to talk about one of, like, if I would categorize one of the more shittiest characters I've seen on a in a film in a while, that is probably Viggo Mortensen's character, because he's kind of spineless.
Yeah, wishy-washy.
Yeah.
When it comes to nuclear war, I'll fall on this side until you convince me to go the other side, and then I'll go, well, wait a second, maybe I shouldn't have switched in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that character is a little problematic.
Just put a gun to my head.
But the movie is really about the other two characters, Captain Ramsey and Zexo
Hunter,
you know. So, Heather, this is a submarine movie that you do like, apparently, so
yes.
What did you like about it?
I mean, it really was just a Denzel and Hackman show. That was it. It's a great script. It's a tight movie. And like you were saying, the tension in it is palpable. And a lot of that is built because I think of the way it was shot. I think the script, I think obviously Tony had a lot to do with that, but Denzel and Gene Hackman just fed off of each other so well. And what I really, really enjoyed is that neither of them were the villains. There wasn't one who was an undermining bad guy. This wasn't a who's right, who's wrong. It was two different ideologies that were facing off with each other, with, you know, thermonuclear war as a possibility by bad decision making, etc. And it was very, very interesting from that aspect. I forgot Viggo was in it entirely. So even though he was my least favorite character in it, I still love him. And he played his part, I think, as well as he obviously could. But it was mostly just the two of them. And the ending kind of, you know, also summed that up nicely as well. There always has to be a big bad or villain in this scenario. And they let it just be the Russians, yeah. Which, thank you. I get really tired of I'm really exhausted with Nazis being the enemy in every movie all the time. I'm like, can we still just have Russians on occasion? I like it when Russians are the bad guys. I love Russians. I love them. It's not
and
a
they
hate
weren't
thing.
Even,
it's
they,
just fun.
They weren't even the regular Russians. They were separatist Russians.
Yes,
you know, that's
yes.
Going on. So it's not like we're pointing the finger at the Russians and saying, shame on you. They were dealing with their own problem, and their problem was becoming our problem. That's the way that this was working. And so
and
I thought, an interesting scenario.
And in the time frame, I think this was still mid-90s, too.
Yeah.
That was not something that, at least for us, that was totally ridiculous. Or, well, now it's a little bit more prevalent. But at the time, it was still, oh, Russia's scary. Russia's
well,
very bad.
Well, the Soviet Union had broken up. And, you know, the Russians had nukes, but there were nukes in the other nations that subsequently became nations again or became separate after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And so there was, and the question was, you know, what's the command and control on all of that sort of thing? When the Soviet Union disappeared, suddenly the question is, well, who's got the trigger on the who's got their finger on the trigger and who gets to call the shots on some of this stuff? And so there is risk on that. That was a very real scenario in those times. I hope it's not the same scenario that's going on in the world now.
agreed.
We've got plenty of things to
worry
about.
I think that absolutely, played into it at the time, too, and worked really well for it.
Yeah. I've always been a big fan of these kinds of, you know, intellectual discussions about what we're supposed to do and how would you face this situation. You know, Failsafe, you know, the comic version of Failsafe, Dr. Strangelove, you know, Twilight's Last Gleaming. There are a lot of these movies from the 60s and 70s that posited this. There was a early movie from Rod Lurie, who is a director you guys might be familiar with.
Of course. His first film was Deterrence.
Was Deterrence, which I think I wrote a review for Rob. And it's really just this kind of intellectual exercise. Well, what are the scenarios? They don't really show, you know, nuclear attacks or bombs. It's all what are the possibilities and who are we trying to outwit and where are the strengths and weaknesses and how fast do we need to act? And I think they build a lot of tension. First of all, you've got two big conflicts going on here. You've got the nuclear conflagration that everybody's worried about, but you also have what is the equivalent of a mutiny on a nuclear submarine between two people who both seem righteous in their views and both have characteristics to them that are admirable. Like Heather said before, it's not like there's a bad guy on the sub. They just have different ways of functioning, and they get to a point where, at the end it all works itself out. Big surprise, the world doesn't end, my friends. I don't mean to spoil it for you, but it doesn't. But it's and like we said, it's an acting class between the two of them. It's a great opportunity to watch, and they both have the kinds of characteristics that I really like in a performance. They feel grounded and real. You know, they only get over the top in situations where you might very well lose your temper. And I like the way, you know, Hackman explodes, but he explodes first after he is snide and sarcastic about something. And Denzel is, you know, he's very cool and calm until there's an action needed that's taken, and then he's, you know, right on top of it. I like the way they played off each other in this movie. And you mentioned Viggo in the background being kind of ineffectual. You did notice that Steve Zahn's in the movie too, right?
Yes!
But of course he doesn't get to do any of his Steve Zahn stuff. He's just another crew member. But it was kind of interesting to have him in the background as well. So, all right, well, we don't get to rate Sean Connery because he didn't show up in this movie, but we do have these two great actors in a submarine movie. So, Heather, what's your rating?
This is 4 out of 5 for me. It's a fantastic movie. And a submarine movie, next to Hunt for Red October, that I recommend.
All right. Joel?
Yeah, same here. 4 out of 5. I was pleasantly surprised. I was expecting that it would going to be much more of a generic submarine film, but it had a lot more depth than that.
All right, and Rob?
Well, I didn't get to say anything about it because you didn't call on me, but that's fine.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Rob. We got sidetracked. Well, before you give your rating, tell us what you thought. Hey, 8 films, sorry, 4 people, and, you know,
lots of movies.
And I changed the order in which I was doing things, so it does happen.
I know we have 8 movies to talk about, so it's fine. It's okay. First of all, once again, this is another movie that I love. I saw it in the theater when it first came out. I've seen it so many times over the years. And as everyone mentioned, it works so well because of the two main characters are written so well, and the way that Denzel and Gene perform them are just superb. I mean, the writing in this movie is just – I can't say how great it is because I can't even explain how great it is because someone just has to sit and watch it, because the ability to put characters in a small space and be able to get so much tension with the situation that they're dealing with. And even as the viewer, you constantly move back and forth between who you think is right and who you think is wrong, even though you know that both are right and both are wrong. You know, Heather mentioned before, I think it was Heather, that there's no real bad guy in this. There's no villain. But when you look at it from one way, these characters are both the heroes and the villains, because of they're both doing things properly, and they're also doing things that they're not supposed to do because of the way they were trained, because of the way, you know, they're because of the ability for these two people who have to work together in order for war to actually happen. And it's something similar to like what you had at the beginning of the movie War Games, you know, where you have John Spencer and I don't remember the other guy sitting in the control room where they both had to turn the key at the same time. You know, even though it was just a drill, the idea is that you can't necessarily put two people in a situation where they have to agree because you don't know what's really going to happen, which is also one of the reasons why at the end of this movie they say that just a few months after this movie came out which came first, they actually took the ability away from the captain and the XO of making the final decision as to whether to launch missiles or not. So yeah, it's a really fun movie. I love it, and I actually give it a 4.5 out of 5.
All right. And I'm going to go 5 for 5. This is probably my favorite, maybe my second favorite film on the list. We'll see. It's, like I said, I can't go wrong with a submarine movie featuring Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington. They'd have really had to screw it up. And with occasional script inserts by Quentin Tarantino again. You know.
I was going to mention that. You're right.
Yeah. So 5 for 5 for me. All right. Well, we need to move on, and Gene Hackman comes back for another Tony Scott action film in the techno-thriller area, Enemy of the State, and this one features Will Smith, and it's either very smart or incredibly stupid. which one do you think?
The thing about Enemy of the State that I really like is that it's a weird stealth sequel to The Conversation. Francis Ford Coppola's masterful film starring Gene Hackman in what I think is his best performance. Here he basically reprises that character, which is insane because it's a Jerry Bruckheimer production and with starring Will Smith, of all people. Once again, big cast. This is Tony Scott getting experimental with cameras and whatnot, with the surveillance world and everything. And I think it works. It does its job at being a kind of espionage thriller, but still has enough going on to make it, you know, constantly moving, which is what Tony Scott movies do. They're fun to watch, and this one is very much fun while taking a bit of a darker turn.
Start with Rob this time so that I don't skip over him.
Richard, I told you, it's fine. You can skip over me. Okay, well, this is, again, another one another one of these movies that made by Tony Scott that I love. This one I also saw in the theater, and I also have seen it numerous times over the years. It's just so clever. I mean, especially for people who've seen The Conversation, because you know that the character that Gene Hackman's playing is either the same character or someone very similar to what he played in a movie that came out 28 years earlier. But the film is the story is set up really, really well. The story writing is built like a puzzle, and they're able to constantly refer back to things that happened earlier or bring things back around that you don't necessarily expect. And and what's really interesting watching this in 2020 is that in some ways it's actually even more relevant to our world as now than it was when it came out 22 years ago, especially because people understand a lot more about the whole idea of global tracking and of cell phones and of, we won't get into politics. Exactly. We'll get into politics aspects of it, but that aspect too. And it's just... It, in some ways, it seems as if it was actually somewhat prophetic in the way that it portrays certain aspects of the story. And Gene Hackman and Will Smith are both great here because they hate each other. And they're constantly bickering the entire way through, even though they know that they need to still work together.
Why did you blow up the building? Because you made a phone call. I mean, I laughed out loud at that line.
Well,
I still remember that. I was in the trailer.
There's when Hackman has that line, it's either very smart or incredibly stupid. Will Smith's character does things that are completely stupid on a regular basis, But that doesn't make him a stupid person. And, right. You know, there's a little bit of inconsistency in that character. Joel, what did you think of this film, or in particular, Will Smith's character?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great film. This is, as I can see from the filmography of Tony Scott, this is the first one that I saw in the theaters. And it's like, as you said, Rob, it's almost like it's more on point now than it was then, because then it was still kind of like science fiction in a way, how the tracking and stuff worked. Mm-hmm. Because it's such a nightmare situation for the Will Smith character. It's like, I remember when I saw it the first time, I was feeling like, shit, he's really getting handed it to him. Because it's like everything is turned against him in a way that's like, I just remember thinking, how the hell are they going to turn this around? How is it going to be like, how are they going to make him come out on top of it? So it's like, I mean, Will Smith is great in it. Also, he plays a likable character, even though he has his infidelity stuff and stuff like that. But it's like, it's a really well-made film. And I rewatched it so many times, but I hadn't seen it in a couple of years. And it was really obvious how important this film is now in how the society looks now, with all the monitoring through cell phones and Facebook, and you know, that ads can turn up just because you're talking about a certain topic in your telephone, and then you have
everybody is listening. Exactly. All the time.
Yep.
So it's a very, very important film, I think, and it's so well done. And I also love how it's obviously that the whole thing with the union thing, you know, in the beginning with the tape, it's only a setup for the ending, so they have a way to work it out. But I like it. It's a really cute scene in the end, how they resolve everything. And it's like, yeah, we just need to wrap it up now. And then they have that one that is kind of like, you know, it says, when Hackman says you're either really stupid or really smart. I mean, it really comes down to that final scene. It's a very lovable film. And if people haven't seen it, they should see it.
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, okay, this...
Call on Heather. One, call on Heather.
Call on Heather, or I'll just interrupt. It's fine. I saw this one in the theater, too, and this is probably one of my favorites of all of Tony Scott's films. It's probably one of my favorite Will Smith films. I thought he was just wonderful in it. This was one of the first ones where I went, he's actually a solid lead man. He's not just, you know, Independence Day guy. But it's a great techno thriller, and like you guys both pointed out too, this maybe wasn't so relevant then, and it was more of science fiction, but it was kind of creepy and unnerving watching it again, going, how often have we done this? How often have we foretold the future through our storytelling? And it's a bit unnerving and eerie, but at the same time, it's extremely entertaining. The action sequences are they come at exactly the right emotional moment, and they peak. The cast is phenomenal. One of the things that I've really noticed watching so many of Tony's movies, too, is he really understands his actors, their strengths, and they work for him. Gene Hackman is in, I don't know, maybe a third of this, and he just is remarkable, which isn't surprising because he's Gene Hackman. But it's still wonderful. You even have little tiny roles like Jake Busey and Scott Kahn, who I love because they do great in roles like this, but they stand out to you, and often those are kind of toss-away roles that you forget about. Everything in this movie works for me. It's absolutely wonderful, and the rewatchability on it is just numerous.
I saw it 6 months ago, and when it came up, when I had to rewatch it for this, I was like, all right, this is great. I'll rewatch it without a problem.
Yeah, it's so good and aged better than it probably should have. Because often with the techno thriller type films, they usually kind of go, well, that ended up not turning out that way, or, you know, in this case.
Yeah. This one, instead of it going in the wrong direction, it's simply outdated because we've gotten more effective and efficient in doing the same kinds of things,
right,
and quickly. The one thing that I see is missing from this film that exists today that would make it even more complicated is social media. Because if you wanted to kill somebody publicly, you wouldn't be doing it in newspapers or on television. It would be a social media a lynching that you would do. And but other than that, it really feels like everybody said, very timely and very relevant to the kinds of things that we are dealing with now with technology. And I like the fact that Hackman is only referred to in the first, you know, two-thirds of the movie. He doesn't show up until the last part of the film, and when he shows up, he's already a cranky old man, and he plays it to the hilt, you know. And
he needs pretzels.
Yeah. And he needs to eat. He needs to eat. I know that feeling. My blood sugar is a little low, you know, and I'm going to be cranky if I don't have something to eat. So, you know, and like Rob mentioned it earlier, that's, I think, everybody who saw this film who'd ever seen The Conversation feels like, well, Harry Call apparently started working for the NSC, and, you know, then he got dumped by them, and he's become the paranoid character that he is in this particular film. Because it's, you know, so much of it is the same. And they, and there's a whole section where they're talking about line of sight when they're trying to record things. And I'm going, yep, that's, you know, right out of The Conversation. They had the same kinds of problems. They spent time addressing that issue in that movie.
And they were doing it in the exact same location.
So it's really, I think, a very effective film. There are a couple of things about it that... I find, you know, it's a movie, you got to suspend your disbelief. So here's the national security guy, you know, these are the smartest counterintelligence people in the world, and where do they decide to commit their crime at the beginning of the story? In public, without checking to see whether or not there is any closed circuit television or other potential places that could give up their information, and their solution to the problem is immediately to begin a 2-hour chase movie. It's a little bit hackneyed. I mean, it's just like, really? And the idea that John Voight's character would be there for, you know, the assassination that takes place, you know,
it's a little convenient.
Yeah, I mean, people are just a little... I mean, if you're one of those people, you got to be smarter than that. Look, everybody likes it, I think, at the end when it turns around and his credit cards are canceled and his bank account is being screwed with and those kinds of issues are coming back. Well, good, you know, that's deserving. But somebody who's in this position in the first place probably would be, you know, thinking... 2 or 3 steps ahead, and they seem like they're always reacting instead of anticipating, and that seems strange for the kinds of people that they're supposed to be. However, the film's very entertaining, and I like the characters quite well. Did we hear from everybody? Does anybody have something else to add about an enemy of the state?
Well, I did react to how tenseful the hunt for the guy that has the tape originally, you know, when he dies and he bicycles across traffic and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I think that chase scene itself is really, really well edited and shot. And it's like, really shows how good Tony Scott is in doing
it. If you watch his last 4 or 5 movies, if you watch the last 4 or 5 movies, you see how many of these overhead shots Tony Scott uses in movies. It's like, you know, let's look down at the city from the satellite. And if he, you know, he was using drone-type cameras, you know, helicopter shots, so much in those films. And, of course, this one, it fits in with the techno element of the movie really well. Supposedly we're spying from a satellite that's, you know, 100 miles up in the atmosphere. Or in just past the atmosphere, but you get a lot of those kinds of overhead shots, and there's more in our next film. There were some in the last film. It's interesting and it's effective. It's a good way of telling the story, especially for this theme.
Yeah, but I mean that's one of those chase scenes also that you have. I've probably seen it like 9 or 10 times now, but it still feels like it's fucking on the. You know, life and death, you know, I still get emotional.
It is.
By it.
Yeah, when he runs, when he gets hit by a fire truck, that's,
That's as like, life is death that you're going to get.
Yeah, that's it. That's pretty much you're done. You're done in that situation. All right, Joel, how about a reading from you?
Four and a half out of five.
All right, and Heather?
4.5 out of 5 for me, too. It's outstanding.
All right, and Rob?
4.5 out of 5.
And I'm going to give it a 4 just because. What the heck?
Because you want to be different.
Yeah, dare to be different. Dare to be different. Okay. Well, we've got a couple more films to talk about, and revenge is the whole point of the slow burn Man on Fire. Denzel's back again in another Tony Scott film. He made 5 films with Tony Scott, and you know what they say, a bullet always tells the truth. Well, were there enough bullets to make this feel true to you?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Man on Fire. Now we're in the like later part of Tony Scott's career where he's really experimenting with his camera work and getting insane with the kind of subtitles on screen and how filters play in and all these other things. Denzel is terrific in this movie. It's a fantastic performance. It's very dark and very gritty. It's going for a very specific vibe. It's way too long, but there's a lot of memorable things about the film that I think really stick out and really stand to reason for people that, you know, love this film very much. I think it works pretty well. Not quite my favorite Tony Scott movie, but certainly has a lot going for it, mainly because Denzel, I think, is really channeling something strong.
All right, let's start with Heather. Heather and I were talking about this a little bit right before the show started, so why don't you share your thoughts, Heather?
Hi, I'm like you, Richard. I love revenge movies. You don't have to turn them into anything crazy or convoluted. You need very little motivation and then just somebody going out to avenge whomever. And in this particular scenario, we all are under the assumption that the little girl is gone forever. Hey. Forever. Yeah. Perhaps she is, perhaps she isn't. But this is what we are told and the information we have at the time. And we don't know that Denzel is a retired, crazy madman. And this is the one thing that makes him snap. I don't know. I don't need any more than that. The rest of the movie is just gold to me. I love every single shot, every single time he explodes someone, kills them, tortures them. And I love that Christopher Walken actually plays the straight character in this. He's just pretty, not over the top, not crazy. This is the, once again, pretty much Denzel show. And it does run a bit long, but this is one of my favorite movies. And I feel like Michael Bay must just sit at home and watch this and just, well, enjoy himself alone with himself on every shot, because there are so many moments in this I go, oh, I've seen Michael Bay try to do that. He doesn't do it as well. I've seen Michael Bay try to do that. He doesn't do it as well. And Michael Bay does what he does very well. So it's not an insult to Michael Bay. It's a compliment to Tony Scott. But it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite movies of his, hands down.
Well, there's an enthusiastic endorsement. Rob, are you as enthusiastic?
No, I'm not as enthusiastic. I enjoy the movie. It's a fun movie. As Heather said, it's a revenge movie where you don't have to really give very much of a reason for this character to snap and want revenge. I thought it was very clever the way that they show how he's going from person to person trying to find the top guy and doing all he can, you know, to threaten each of these people in order to get move up to the next level. And his methods are very unique and clever. And, you know, the pretty strapping a guy's hands to the steering wheel, that's a pretty interesting one. And then they top it later with you know, having a little missile in someone, in someone's other end. So, yeah, I mean, Denzel does a nice job here. I'm not as much of a Denzel fan as you are, Richard. I think most of the time his characters are very similar. And I found that in this movie, he basically this was a precursor for all of his Equalizer movies and, you know, all the other action revenge thrillers that he's done since. Yeah. Since. So it's hard to differentiate between this role and the other roles. I guess he's like, you know, Liam Neeson and Keanu Reeves, where they just,
found a niche for them in the revenge genre and moved forward with
it. Before he was an equalizer, Creasy is the character in there. We just changed the name.
It's a little bit of a
without
spoiling anything, it's a problem. But you never know. You never know.
Joel, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, it's an interesting film because I do feel like it's kind of, as I mentioned with True Romance, feeling very much like a Quentin Tarantino film. I feel like this is probably not what I would, if I just would blindly see 10 Tony Scott films and then they would tell me that one of them is not directed by him, I probably would say this one because it feels like it's...
Unless you saw The Hunger.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Because it's like this one feels more meaty and serious in a gritty way that I don't find most of his films... in a way, so it kind of sticks out. Like he felt like, okay, I've done these kind of like more easy consumed action films, and now I want to do something more meaty and maybe get some acclaim for more darker themes and stuff. But it's still a great film. I love it very much. And my favorite torture thing is when he uses the cigarette lighter in the car after he clips the fingertips. On the guy
bleeding.
Yeah, so it's like, and also I do really like the connection between Denzel and Dakota Fanning. They are so good together, and they have this development where she learns to swim better, and he coaches her, and he is more of a father figure than her real father. So it's a great film. As I said, maybe not my typical Tony Scott film, but it's still a really solid film.
All right, and Heather's already tipped my hand a little bit. I love this movie. I love revenge movies. And for a decade after this, Denzel has been, they're badass Denzel. Is this movie feature Denzel with a gun? Okay, I'm going to go see that. That's all I needed to know. And it's a result of this film. He'd made other films where he was a heroic figure before, but this is like the template for all of those characters Rob mentioned, like in The Equalizer, or what was the one that he was in with Ryan Reynolds?
Safe House.
And Book of Eli, and there's just a ton of those things that he's made in the last 15 years where he is the designated badass in the movie, and this is the template for it. But what's nice about this film is that it's not just that. I mean, for the first hour and a half, it's practically none of that. We're getting just character development, and we're getting the scenario set up. And, it seems very manipulative to have a child at the center of the story who's the motivation for the revenge. And if you did it right, if you did it wrong, it would just feel cheap. They didn't do it wrong. They did it right. They took their time. He doesn't fall for her immediately. He's resistant to her. He doesn't want to get involved. He has his problems. It's not like there's a sudden spot where there's a breakthrough. It's a gradual breakthrough where he begins to feel again like there is something to have in life. And, that her disappearing and potential death, are the tipping point. Is not a surprise at all. And when he says that line to the mom, is I'm going to find them and I'm going to kill them all. And anybody who profited from it, who was in on it, they're going to get it. And I do think they temper it a little bit because there is one person that he doesn't kill that he encounters that is involved in it. And sexist bastard that he is, it's a woman.
It was an older woman.
Yeah, but otherwise, everybody else gets what they deserve. And
isn't that just so fulfilling, though?
That's exactly it. We would be cringing at the torture if it was our hero being tortured. We would feel horrible about a character that we cared about and wanted to survive and be the hero if they were treated the way that he treats them. But because we know that they are the scum of the earth, that we take such satisfaction from every indignity, every cruelty, every cold-ass comment that he makes to them at the end, you know, I wish you had more time. he's got a cold-hearted comment to make to everybody he's dispatching, and I'm sorry, it probably says something about me as a human being, and maybe not something very positive that I respond to those kinds of films.
I'm right there. So, there's somewhat validation. There's so many awful things that we see in the world all the time, and it's more often than not that we don't see the evil punished. And yes, it's just fiction. Yes, it's just a film for entertainment. But there is something about that, even if it's in this horrific way. They've also, as you said, tempered it so we have been, yes, manipulated, but it also works. That's what we're signing up for.
Exactly.
In order to have that feeling and that connection, and then to go, all right, well, we put you through this hell, so now you're going to get to watch them go through hell. And that's also what makes it rewatchable, too, because it's still an ordeal to go through.
Yes, it is. As we were saying before, this is a long film. It's 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And it's not until the last hour that we get to the revenge business. You know, there's a lot of setup, but it's good setup. And I agree that Christopher Walken is interesting because he's playing a straighter character. And Giancarlo Giannini showing up in the movie.
Yeah.
I'm going, oh my gosh. You know, there's a lot of good people in this movie. But we do need to go on because we are getting a little long in the tooth here when it comes to our discussion. So let's do a quick ratings on these. Rob?
I'm going to go with a 3.5 on this.
All right. And Heather?
4 out of 5. Fantastic.
All right. Joel?
3.5 out of 5.
Yeah, and for me, it's a 5 because I could watch this one again today. I watched it yesterday, and I could watch it again today.
Enjoy.
I like these kinds of films. All right, well, finally, Denzel does not take on rogue Russian separatists or Mexican gangsters in his final Tony Scott film, also the final film of Tony Scott. Instead, it's an unstoppable train that through a series of confluence of events, he and a trainee conductor,
i.e. stupidity,
have to kind of regain control over it and prevent a huge disaster. So do you think the film was a disaster, or do you think it's a victory lap for the director?
So we skip a lot getting back to Unstoppable, his last feature, which is sad because Tony Scott, I think, makes terrific films, and it's a shame that he had to go. But Unstoppable, a hell of a film to end on. I think this movie's massively entertaining. I love that there's no, like, villains in this film, technically. There's, like, bad politics or whatnot, but like it's about blue collar guys doing a job, and I think Denzel once again is great at this. Chris Pine is also very good. They're both just guys that have to do this thing, and I think it really works in a kind of blue collar disaster film level that's really well crafted, very entertaining, stylish but not overly done. Just a really fun ride.
Heather, let's start with you.
Okay, to be fair, this was my least favorite Tony Scott film by a long shot. But the first time I watched it, I may have been heavily inebriated. In fact, you could say I was heavily inebriated. And I remember yelling at the screen over and over again, pretty much telling everyone how stupid they were for the whole thing. And then, you know, the joke that Kai and I had forever was the train stopped. But I never gave it a second chance. So last night, watched it again for the first time in probably 8 or 9 years. And it's not as bad as I initially thought. But it still is not good. Of all of his films, there's always, even when it's more superficial, I feel like there's some emotional connection to the actors. There's even when they're somewhat unlikable, they bring something to the table that makes you like them. Like Christian Slater, sleazy. Yeah, still like him. Tom Cruise is kind of an asshole in Top Gun, but you like him. I love Denzel in this, but I don't think I could watch it without him in it. If you replaced him with another actor in it, I don't think it would be enjoyable at all. I love all of the shots of the train. Rosario Dawson was wonderful in it. I love her, and it made me wonder again why she isn't in more movies. I like Chris Pine a lot. He's completely dull and just generic white guy in this. I mean, there's just no real emotional connection to the characters or the story itself. And the story itself is actually pretty good, which is the part that I missed last time because I was busy being an idiot. The actual action with the train was pretty cool. The concept itself was pretty cool. I loved watching all of the shots of it. It was great, but it still falls way, way short. If you remove Denzel from it and it wasn't Tony Scott's name attached to it, I think it would be completely lost in time. So
at the bottom of Heather's list.
Yeah, right. Well, and then there's so many problems with it too that you don't typically see in a lot of these films for him, where at the end, well, we can't go around the track. Now we're going to have a tipping on the side. All these people are lined up at these places that things are supposed to explode. There's just so much stupidity on top of the stupidity that instigated the event to happen in the first place, that I just couldn't take it anymore, and it just became annoying rather than tense, I guess.
Joel, do you agree with Heather, or did you like the film better than she did?
This was also my second time watching it, and I remember the first time just comparing it to Runaway Train, and then it's a really rough comparison because it's hard to measure up to such a good film. So I tried to see it more like its own thing this time, but I do feel like this is one of the few films where where Tony Scott doesn't feel too invested in his film. Also, the thing that I really liked was the back and forth between Denzel and Chris Pine. I really don't like Chris Pine, but I do think that he actually shows some good acting here, and they're back and forth, and you know, Denzel is the typical grumpy old employee that you have as a colleague and you have stumbled upon in a different when you work at different places, so he's just this total realistic guy, I think, and I like those parts when they get to have dialogue and tell about their lives to each other, so I like that part, but it feels very outdrawn to be a feature film. I mean, in a dream world, it would have been like a short film or something, I think, mainly focusing on that a lot more. Yeah, it's going to go lower on the ratings of these films, I feel.
Okay, Rob, I didn't forget you.
Well, that's okay. It's a good thing because I actually enjoyed this movie more than both Heather and Joel did, based on what they said. Again, as you mentioned earlier, you know, as a movie lover, you have to a lot of times have suspension of disbelief. And this is one of those movies. It's just such a fun movie. Yes, it's stupid in certain ways of how all the chain of events, you know, play out in order for things to happen the way they do. When I put up a review of this movie, I think it was yesterday, so someone wrote to me saying that they've worked in trains for 40 years, and this is nowhere even close to what could happen. And I think that's part of why we enjoy watching movies. We like watching things, even if they are a little bit too much or completely unrealistic from that perspective, because they're at least presented in a way that makes them feel somewhat realistic. This is just a fun action thriller that's able to make the main character a train. I mean, Denzel and Chris Pine are both pretty good here, but they both play, you know, average Joes. They don't play anything very heroic or anything like that. I mean, Chris Pine has obviously played the heroic character numerous times. So has Denzel. But in this movie, neither of them, they're just regular working class guys, you know, on a train that decide to try to save people before the other train, you know, crashes or whatever it is. So it's the main character here is the train. And if you look at the movie from that perspective, again, it's so much fun because this train is just trying to get away from everybody and try to just go do its own thing. And everyone's trying to stop it, and no one is able to think of any smart way to do it because everything they try to do just doesn't work. And it falls on the side. and the film is able to, Tony Scott basically is able to build up this tension by having, again, a movie about a train. Maybe you could call the train Thomas, or the little engine that could, or something like that. And you know, during the course of the movie, they give us numerous scenarios where this train is about to cause a lot of damage to your typical things that are thrown into movies. You have, you know, a train load of kids, and you have a bridge that seems like something out of Speed, where the train has to be able to make the turn, and you have, you know, the heroic engineer that they decide to put in the train to try to stop it, and then you have the former combat soldier that's willing to rappel down and try and stop the train. You know, like all these little things, they're fun to watch. It doesn't necessarily make it a movie that one will want to see over and over and over, but it has its moments. And if you think of it just as a fun popcorn movie, I think you can get more out of it. And that's why I like it. I can't say I love it, but it was a fun movie to watch. And, you know, it was a great 2 hours to sit and watch.
I can say that in general for the most part. However, then there are big moments that I can't get out of my head and ruin it for me. Like Denzel running across the top of the train. Okay, so he's going and he's using the manual brakes. Awesome. So all of a sudden he's on like halfway across. Why doesn't he just go to the engines up front?
Because he runs out of breath.
I mean, there's
there's a gap and the next car is all pipes. It's not really something that he can jump onto, so it's a little bit problematic. They don't explain it very well, but yeah, there's a reason that he can't keep going. You know,
he should have explained that, I think, because I had the same feeling as Heather. Why the hell doesn't he just run all the way and stop it?
Yeah, and there was a few cars before the pipes too, so he could have still gone ahead and used the manual brakes on those. And I mean, it's a little thing, but that's exactly it. It's a little thing, so why don't you just have him stop at the pipes? Then that wouldn't be running through my head. Like, why is he just sitting there? Why is Chris Pine with his broken foot jumping on the train? What the heck is this? Is ridiculous, even for me. There's such thing as suspension of disbelief, and then there's
there's complete disbelief.
Yeah, and that was and you know what? I would say honestly too, Rob, it did work way better for me until we started to get to the end, and then those things started to happen, and it was one thing after another, and then I started to get pissed off again.
Okay, I can hear that.
Yeah, yeah, but I agree with what you said about it being the train is the main character, and those parts were very enjoyable for me too.
Well, for me, I end up closer to Rob than I do the other folks here because I found it entertaining, but it's entertaining in the way that all disaster movies are entertaining. You've got a scenario that they're going to ratchet up the tension. We're going to find a solution. The solution's not going to work. We increase the risk that's going on. We got to come up with another solution. And a lot of the things that they come up with are things. When I was I remember seeing this the first time in theaters. I watched it a few years later with a group of friends, and we all enjoyed it. You know, simple evening's entertainment, something that everybody could watch. And then I watched it yesterday, and it's like, this, Rob said it, it's a popcorn movie. It's Airport. It's what's that climate change movie with Jake Gyllenhaal? It's it's like, okay, what else can go wrong here? But as you're going through the process, I kept thinking, well, if I was trying to fix this, what would I do? Get an engine in front and try and slow it down. You know what? They thought of that. Derail it. But you got to derail it in the right place. So that screws up the tension. Put a engineer on there using a helicopter. See if you can jump forward and use the individual brakes. All of those things, they play out, and it's like, yeah, I guess, you know, as you're getting more and more desperate, you say, what else could I do? What else is there to do? What else is to do? And I thought, well, they're not any faster at this than I am, you know, and it's their business. You would think they would have some idea. The whole scenario, of course, happens because of stupidity, And I like the fact at the end that they, you know, they do a review of the characters, and he's working in the fast food industry. Yeah, yep, he should be, you know, because that was a dumbass move, you know. There's a reason that you do things for safety and security, and there's a perfect example of, oh, I think I can just shortcut something, and boy, do you regret doing it. I think the train is the star of the movie, you know, and we've said that before. All right, we've been almost 2 hours without the rest of our show, so we need to close this down. Let's get our quick numbers on this and then take a break. Heather, obviously it's not going to be a high number for you.
No, there was a Thomas the Train episode called Accidents Happen, and I feel like this was probably one of them. This is going to be a 2 out of 5 for me, and that's an upgrade from before.
All right. And Joel, you also on the low end, right?
Yeah, 2.5. It's for me.
All right. Rob, you feel a little bit better about it?
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
All right. And I'll give it 3.5. Like I said, it's entertaining, but there are some things about it that are kind of stupid. All right. Well, folks, that's it for our Tony Scott discussion. Head over to the Lamb to see what others might have thought about these films. And we'll be right back with some rants, raves, reviews, and a very quick game after this message from a fellow Lamb Podcasting Network show.
I was having serious problems in the bedroom, and in the car, and on the bus. But I couldn't help but think there had to be something out there for people suffering just like me.
Podcast dysfunction affects 6 out of 7 cinema geeks out there, but there is help. The Simplistic Reviews Podcast.
Symptoms of the Simplistic Reviews Podcast may include loss of sleep, loss of hair, longer erections, lost family get-together, bleeding of eyes, ears, and anus, divorce, hated by town folk, rash, the ability to drink alcohol and podcast at the same time, mansplain, weight gain, weight loss, people with severe podcasting games, depression, happiness, growth of boobs and hair on chest, constant peeing, watery eyes, and 3 additional inches on your penis, and if you don't have a penis, you will now.
Thanks to the Simplistic Reviews Podcast, I'm no longer bored in the bedroom. Plus, I have a perpetual erection. Although I think I'm going blind.
The Simplistic Reviews Podcast. A small price to pay for entertainment.
I don't know what we're yelling about!
Welcome back, everybody. It's time for some rants, raves, and reviews. And Joel, what have you got to rant, rave, or review about this week?
The rave, I'm just going to keep it to a rave because we're doing a long show, and I really have one topic that I want to talk about, and it's going to be hard because I'm going to have to avoid some serious spoilers. But I just finished a video game called The Last of Us Part 2.
Oh!
And I don't know if any one of you guys are gamers. I know Heather plays some, I think.
No, I'm not. Not at all.
Yeah, no.
I don't have time to play games.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a very long-awaited game. I've been waiting for it for 7 years, and it's a PlayStation exclusive, so it's only available on PlayStation. And the first game is very memorable because it's like one of these kind of life-changing experiences when it comes to gaming. It's a really, really, really good video game that is almost kind of like playing your own Hollywood film. And the second one is very the reception has been very controversial on it. My take that I just want to share with everyone is that the fucking review smearing that's going on is so completely wrong, because this is a great game. It's really, really, really good. It's a lot different than the first game. And I would never have, you know, having waited 7 years for it, I've had my, you know, own share of fantasizing how I would want the second game to be. And I would never have come up with the idea that they made. But it actually turned out fine. It's the first time it has happened, because I feel like they tried to do similar stuff with the new Star Wars films, but they completely failed at it. That where they tried to put some new blood in it, and then they just... then they just failed, because in the end they've went back to the well, but they did it in the wrong they did some wrong choices there. So with this time they actually did go out of the box completely to change it up, because it is very different from the first game, but it still works, and it's a really good improvement. And for people that have heard about the big change in the second game, if you like the first one, try it out anyway. It's like, even though that part might have been spoiled for you, the game is still worth playing if you're open-minded.
One more time with the name of the game.
The Last of Us Part 2. Yeah.
Joel, most of the people I know that have been playing it, I'm an Xbox girl. Yeah. But this is one of the games that always, and God of War, made me want to get another PlayStation. It's been since PlayStation 2 since I've had one. But most of the people I know that have been playing it have loved it. So I haven't read any particular reviews myself because I don't have a PlayStation, but word around the campfire is it's actually quite good.
Yeah.
For the most part, from what I've heard anyway.
It's a very divided game. As you say, I've understood it as well, that it is well received, but it is concerning that the internet trolls and a lot of people that haven't even played the games are like smearing it on review sites and dragging down the score. On one of the Metacritic sites, it's like averaging 3 out of 10, and it's like thousands of 0 out of 10 reviews on there. That's not, it just doesn't make sense. So this is more like consumer briefing to people that it is actually still good, even though it's a bit different than the first game, because it really is. And I can understand if hardcore people have trouble with the new game, but it's still worth it, I think, if you have an open mind about it. It's kind of hard to not go into spoilers, because that would make it easier, but I'm just saying that I think if you have a PlayStation and you think you like the first game and you heard like that the second one is so different, vastly different, and a certain thing happened that might turn you off if you played the first game, I say still play it, because I think it might blow your mind. It did for me completely, so it's very well worth playing.
Good deal, good deal. All right, Heather, what are you ranting, raving, or reviewing?
In honor of Jay, I'm going to have a rave, and I'll keep it relatively short. I finally just got Disney Plus, guys.
Ah.
Okay, so
what'd you get?
Disney Plus.
Disney Plus.
Disney Plus. I didn't hear the word Disney.
Yes. Sorry, I said it breathily because I'm excited about it.
Finish The Mandalorian in one day?
I did, and I actually watched it with my 3.5-year-old who loves it and keeps asking to rewatch. Let's watch Mandalorian, Baby Yoda. I'm like, dude, this is awesome. It might be because I give him popcorn every time we watch it, but I don't care. I will totally indoctrinate that child. I've been enjoying it. Most of the Pixar films that I love, I already own. I own Star Wars. I did go through all the Marvel films in chronological order. So that was kind of fun. And I worked from home for the last 9 years. So this pandemic being stuck at home thing wasn't new for me. However, I've been needing something new in the background for noise, and I'm just madly in love with the National Geographic part on there, and that's what I have been listening to at work, and my mind has been peaceful during the day, and I get to watch bears and cheetahs and Siberia and Russian animals trying to survive. Oh, I just love it. I loved the Discovery Channel when they used to actually have animals and shows on all the time like this. So this is just heaven for me. So yay, Disney Plus. I finally got it. And definitely Mandalorian.
All right. Well, thank you for the rave. We're always looking for the good things in this part of the world at this time of the pandemic. And it sounds like it's something good in your life. Good. Good. Rob, how about you?
As always, I get to rave because I get to watch movies all the time. is there a better reason to rave? as always, I'm always watching more and more movies every day. And Joel mentioned something earlier that surprised me. He was talking about the fact that, he had never seen, I think you mentioned it was True Romance, and he was very happy to finally come across a movie that he loved so much that he had never even heard of and didn't know anything about. And that's one of the reasons why I love watching movies that I've never seen or heard of before, because I'm trying to find those diamonds in the rough. And last week I actually came across one that I can't even explain how I came across it. It's a movie called Report to the Commissioner from 1975.
Oh, I love that movie.
So do I now. It was a movie that I knew nothing about, and it was just so amazing. I'm not going to spoil anything for anybody, but what I basically it starts off with a scene where there's a shootout where they have two patrolmen that come across the dead body of a woman, and they try to figure out what really happened that caused all of this. And the whole premise of the movie is that the higher ups in the New York Police Department have to finally explain to the commissioner what happened, because apparently nothing is as it seems. And the fact that a movie was made 45 years ago in this way it still blows my mind, because they're telling little short stories about all the different characters and it's all being told in a non-linear fashion, where you have to put it all together to try and figure out, okay, how is this, how did all these events affect the future events and stuff like that. And every so often they tell you the date, and the dates don't go in order, and they keep jumping around because
Tarantino invented non-linear storytelling.
No, I know he didn't.
Through the 70s.
I know he didn't invent it, but I'm saying this was just done really, really cleverly. So if anyone wants to see a really, really fun crime drama from the 70s, you should try to find a copy of Report to the Commissioner from 1975. It's just such a great and fun film. And it's got a great cast also. I mean, you got Yaphet Kotto, and you got
Michael Moriarty.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is the kind of movie I grew up on. This is the stuff that filled my youth. And those gritty New York films from the 70s, they haunt my dreams. And this is a good film. This is a good film. Thank you for recommending it. Now, what I'm going to be recommending and endorsing is the complete opposite. It's not gritty. It's not intelligent. It looks like it's giant stupidity, and I love the idea of it. I just saw the trailer for Greenland. Has anybody else seen this?
No.
Nope. I stay away from trailers because they ruin
me. All right. Well, it's a Gerard Butler end-of-the-world disaster movie. It's basically Armageddon meets, Olympus Has Fallen.
That sounds like fun.
It's going to be Gerard Butler confronting authorities, trying to rescue his family from the upcoming disaster being caused by a plague of meteorites hitting the planet. And it looks big and dumb and a lot of fun. It's opening later this year. I had never heard of it. I didn't know anything about it. I saw the trailer. I said, yeah, I'm going to need 2 buckets of popcorn for this one. This will be fun in the fall, assuming we ever get back to the movie theaters in the fall. All right, let's play a game. This is a game that I've played on the show before. I think it's pretty simple. It's called Who Am I? You're going to receive a series of clues to the identity of an actor who appears in a Tony Scott film. Right. Ooh. And
would you be the actor or the character?
I stuck with the actors. I could have done characters, but I just stuck with actors. So you're naming the actor. Now, the earlier you guess, the greater the points. But if you guess incorrectly, you're out for the rest of that particular character. And if you get it on the first clue, it's 5 points. If you get it on the second clue, it's 4, and so on. And your name is your buzzer. And the first one to 10 points is the winner. So you got to be careful, because the clues might apply to multiple actors in the films. Uh-huh. So you have to decide whether or not you want to take the risk or not.
Historically, I do terrible at these, so let's go for it.
Yeah.
Right? And some of them are easier than others. Some of them are a little bit more complicated, but some of them are relatively easy. All right. For our first actor, the first clue is, I am a comedian specializing in improvisation and sketch comedy. Nobody's got a guess there. My second clue, in my most recent film, I am all wet.
Well.
The third clue? Many people think my character in Deadpool actually describes me. Fourth clue, my greatest performance was as Ranger Jones in Yogi Bear 3D.
I wish that helped me. What?
And the last clue here is I played Gleesy, one of the screw-ups in Unstoppable.
Oh, what is his name?
Rob.
Rob.
Ethan Suplee?
Nope.
No. Okay.
You picked the wrong one.
Oh. I can't think of his name. In fact, when I was watching it, I go, hey, it's that guy from that movie in that movie.
One. All right. T.J. Miller. All right. So nobody got a point on that one. That was one of the harder ones.
Okay. Thank you.
I hope so.
Yeah, I think the other ones will be a little bit easier.
Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of dead air for the podcast. I'll start shouting out ridiculous answers.
All right. Next one. I worked with Tony Scott 4 times.
Heather. Who is Gene Hackman?
That was a good guess, but that's not it. You are now out.
And I did Jeopardy.
All right. I play a character in another movie with the same nickname as the dog in Crimson Tide.
Oh, what?
Oh.
I can't remember the dog's name. Damn.
Yeah, but you're looking for the actor. The dog's name would be a clue.
I'd
Crimson
that.
Tide. There's a reason the dog has the name. I'm giving clues here. All right, the next clue is kind of depressing. I died exactly 10 months after Tony Scott.
Oh. Well, that's not who I was thinking of.
No, he only played...
Oh, I know, Rob.
Rob.
James Gandolfini?
That is correct.
Oh, yeah.
So what, 3 points for Rob.
What was the name of the dog?
Bear.
Bear, okay. There you go.
Bear Bryant,
of course,
the
that's
coach
in,
of the Crimson Tide. All right. So 3 points for Rob.
Ooh.
All right, our next one. In a remake of a famous film, I played the same part as John Gavin. Second clue. I joined a famous movie series replacing another actor after shooting had already started.
Oh, Joel?
Joel.
Viggo Mortensen.
That is correct. 4 points for Joel.
Shame on me not getting Viggo.
All right. Our next clue. I've made 3 movies with Tony Scott. His second was my third.
Joel. This might be going wrong. I might be off completely. Tom Cruise.
That is not correct. So you are out for the rest of this actor.
Heather. Val Kilmer.
Heather scores 5 points.
Wow, very nice.
Very good.
That was in True Romance. I forgot that he was the Elvis.
Yes, the mentor. Yes. All right, our next one. I only made 1 film with Tony Scott, despite having 161 acting credits.
Joel.
Joel.
Oh, fuck, it can't be him. Yes, Dennis Hopper.
That might be an accurate one, but that's not the character that I'm talking... That's not the actor we're looking at. So, that's not the answer we're looking for, is the old saying. All right.
161, wow.
Yeah.
My character dies in the first 10 minutes of my one Tony Scott film.
Oh, Jason Robards. Rob.
That's a good guess. That's not correct, though.
Oh, well.
Oh, I think I know it now. If they are out, let me have another go at it.
Oh, that's... Well, we got Heather's on target right now.
I haven't
but
guessed
yet. She gets more clues. Now, if we get to the end and nobody's got a clue, I'm willing to let you back in. All right?
No, I was thinking... I was actually... I don't know. I thought I knew, and then I realized that person doesn't die.
Okay. Third clue. My character's name was Mike.
Nope, I still don't know.
All right. I was the best friend sleeping with the hero's wife.
Oh, okay.
It's McGill. Is it John McGill? Tim McGill.
I'll give you credit for McGill. Bruce McGill.
Bruce, yes, and The Last Boy Scout.
Yes. So because that's 2 points for Heather. You did get it.
Oh.
Wow. Bruce McGill is 161. Wow.
That's crazy. I told Mike when we were watching it, I go, hey, I said, look at him. That's that guy that's in everything.
Yes.
Apparently.
He'll go, I know that guy. I'll go, yeah, he's been in everything. If it's somebody like him who's been in a ton of things. I didn't realize he'd been in that many movies.
He's in a ton of stuff.
Wow.
All right. Our next one. I made 4 Westerns immediately before appearing in my first Tony Scott film. Right, next. I'm a 2-time Oscar winner who made multiple films with Tony Scott. Rob.
Oh.
Actually, who made multiple films? Uh-oh. I'm just going to say Denzel.
Rob is out.
No.
That is not correct.
Can you read the clue to them?
Sure. The first one was, I made 4 Westerns immediately before appearing in my first Tony Scott film.
Yeah.
I am a 2-time Oscar winner who made multiple films with Tony Scott.
Heather. Gene Hackman?
That is correct.
Yes, I thought, Quick and the Dead was right before that, I thought.
For some reason, I was thinking
that's
of...
That's 4 points for Heather. You've now reached 11 points. Heather wins.
Oh my goodness, I won! Guys, this is monumental. I never win any of the games on the Lambcast. Or anything,
really. Yeah.
All right. So, as the winner, you get to plug first. So, Heather, what do you have to plug?
You can find me at headertime.com. I haven't been writing lately, but I think I might actually do a Tony Scott write-up after this. And Kai and I are going to be doing an anniversary episode. But don't tell anyone. Because I'm not going to believe it 100% until we record this week.
Is that the MILFcast?
Yeah, we're going to do a 10-year husband, wife, internet, makeup again.
When was the last time you did a fresh MILFcast?
Oh, it's been a year and a half, I think. Vern just was messaging us saying, will you guys please get back together? we've tried to. We wanted to, but we both suck. So we are supposed to record this week, but it's supposed to be a secret, but I'm really bad at keeping secrets, so.
Okay. Joel, I didn't know if you had a website or a blog or a podcast to promote, so what have you got to promote? Anything?
Yeah, I mean, it's I feel so honored that I'm actually, still, being invited on these things, even though I haven't touched a blog in, years. And I'm not really into social media as well, so I'm quite unfindable unless you Google my full name. But I mean, it's just an honor to be on as guests from time to time. So thanks.
Joel, you're an OG.
Yes. There you go.
You got alumni rights.
Yeah.
That's it. Rob, I know that you probably have 100 things to plug, so what do you want to pick?
Well, as everyone knows, I watch and review a few movies every day. I'm closing in on my 6,700th movie review, which I will hopefully get to in the middle of July. This coming month's genre grandeur on my site was chosen by Howard Kastner, and we'll be dealing with French film noir. So if anyone has anything, any reviews of movies that deal with that theme, or if they want to watch and then review, they can send them to me. Get them to me by the 25th of July, please. You can send them to doesn't matter what you write at the beginning of the email address, just at movierob.net. You can put your own name, put my name. You can put Howard's name, whatever you want. You can put Richard's name. Or Heather's, or Joel's, whatever you want. As long as the end is movierob.net, and then I'll get the email. So, hoping to get a lot of reviews for that, and also hoping to watch a lot of films that I have never heard of and didn't know anything about for that. So, yeah. All right, well, this month's Acting School 101 feature on The Lamb will be featuring Wesley Snipes movies. So, feel free to send us all of your reviews of movies that Wesley Snipes has been in.
Looking forward to reading some of those. Very good.
You can write one too, Richard. You're more than
I will try. I'm in the middle of refinancing a house, buying a house, packing to move, adopting a new dog. And damn it, there hasn't been a movie theater open for a while, so I don't have much to plug or much to write about. I've got to catch up with the world. Boy, the Lambcast has been the only outlet I've had recently, so I'll try and catch up. If I can put something together, I'll do that for you, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
You're always welcome.
And I don't have anything to plug, anything new. The last thing I plugged is the same thing I'd be plugging now. I've got a review of Becky up, which is an exploitation film that I managed to see in a drive-in 2 weeks ago. I'm looking forward to theaters opening again, but every time I look forward to that, they push it back a little bit more. Tenet got pushed back. Mulan got pushed back. I'm not sure anybody wants to be first back in the queue. They're all nervous about it. And I understand their nerves, but I'm ready to go to a theater, please, so let's eat some popcorn. All right. Well, I'd like to thank again all my guests for being with me today and sharing with you their opinions of Tony Scott. So, Joel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Rob?
Water is wet, the sky is blue, women have secrets. Hey, who gives a fuck?
Heather?
I'll be your wingman anytime.
All right. And as for me, my art is talking, and I have yet to create my masterpiece.
You've been listening to The Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on The Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
You've been listening to The Lambcast. If you've got an idea for a show, any improvements we can make, or you'd like to be a guest on an upcoming episode, find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, @Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. And please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Go to hell. Oh no. Sheep go to heaven. Goats go to hell.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.